it was a poorer hand than he suspected. Mr. Barsad saw losing cards in it that Sidney Carton knew nothing of. Thrown out of his honourable employment in England, through too much unsuccessful hard swearing there, not because he was not wanted there. Our English reasons for vaunting our superiority to secrecy and spies are of very modern date. He knew that he had crossed the Channel and accepted service in France, first as a tempter and an eavesdropper among his own countrymen there, gradually as a tempter and an eavesdropper among the natives. He knew that under the overthrown government he had been a spy upon Saint-Antoine and Defarge's wine shop, had received from the watchful police such heads of information concerning Dr. Manette's imprisonment, release, and history as should serve him for an introduction to familiar conversation with the Defarges, and tried them on, Madame Defarge, and had broken down with them, signally. He always remembered with fear and trembling that that terrible woman had knitted when he talked with her, and had looked ominously at him as her fingers moved. He had since seen her in the section of Saint-Antoine, over and over again produce her knitted registers, and denounce people whose lives the guillotine then surely swallowed up. He knew, as everyone employed as he was, did, that he was never safe, that flight was impossible, that he was tied fast under the shadow of the axe, and that in spite of his utmost tergiversation and treachery in furtherance of the reigning terror, a word might bring it down upon him. Once denounced, and on such grave grounds as had just now been suggested to his mind, he foresaw that the dreadful woman of whose unrelenting character he had seen many proofs would produce against him that fatal register, and would quash his last chance of life. Besides that all secret men are men soon terrified, here were surely cards enough of one black suit to justify the holder in growing rather livid as he turned them over. "You scarcely seem to like your hand," said Sidney, with the greatest composure. "Do you play?" "I think, sir," said the spy, in the meanest manner, as he turned to Mr. Lorry, "I may appeal to a gentleman of your years and benevolence to put it to this other gentleman, so much your junior, whether he can, under any circumstances, reconcile it to his station to play that ace of which he has spoken. I admit that I'm a spy, that it is considered a discreditable station, though it must be filled by somebody. But this gentleman is no spy, and why should he so demean himself as to make himself one? I play my ace, Mr. Barr said, taking the answer on himself and looking at his watch, without any scruple, in a very few minutes. I should have hoped, gentlemen both, said the spy, always striving to hook Mr. Lorry into the discussion, that your respect for my sister, I could not better testify my respect for your sister, than by finally relieving her of her brother, said Sidney Carton. You think not, sir. I've thoroughly made up my mind about it. The smooth manner of the spy, curiously in dissonance with his ostentatiously rough dress, and probably with his usual demeanour, received such a check from the inscrutability of Carton, who was a mystery to wiser and honester men than he, that it faltered here and failed him. While he was at a loss, Carton said, resuming his former air of contemplating cards, "And indeed, now I think again, I have a strong impression that I have another good card here, not yet enumerated. That friend and fellow sheep who spoke of himself as pasturing in the country prisons, who was he?" "French, you don't know him," said the spy quickly. "French, eh?" repeated Carton, musing, and not appearing to notice him at all, although he echoed his word. "Well, he may be." "He is, I assure you," said the spy, "though it's not important." "Though it's not important," repeated Carton in the same mechanical way. "Though it's not important. No. It's not important. No. Yet I know the face." "I think not. I'm sure not. It can't be," said the spy. "It can't be," muttered Sidney Carton retrospectively, and idling his glass, which fortunately was a small one, again. "Can't be." spoke good French. Yet like a foreigner, I thought. Provincial, said the spy. No. Foreign, cried Carton, striking his open hand on the table as a light broke clearly on his mind. Clyde! Disguised, but the same man. We have that man before us at the Old Bailey. Now, there you are hasty, sir, said Bassett, with a smile that gave his aquiline nose an extra inclination to one side. There you really give me an advantage over you. Clyde, who I will unreservedly admit at this distance of time was a partner of mine, has been dead several years. I attended him in his last illness. He was buried in London at the Church of St. Pancras in the Fields. His unpopularity with the blackguard multitude at the moment prevented my following his remains, but I helped to lay him in his coffin. Here Mr. Lorry became aware from where he sat of a most remarkable goblin shadow on the wall. Tracing it to its source, he discovered it to be caused by a sudden, extraordinary rising and stiffening of all the risen and stiff hair on Mr. Cruncher's head. "Let us be reasonable," said the spy, "and let us be fair. To show you how mistaken you are, and what an unfounded assumption yours is, I will lay before you a certificate of Cly's burial, which I happen to have carried in my pocket-book." With a hurried hand, he produced and opened it ever since. There it is. "Oh, look at it, look at it. You may take it in your hand. It's no forgery." Here Mr. Lorry perceived the reflection on the wall to elongate, and Mr. Cruncher rose and stepped forward. His hair could not have been more violently on end if it had been that moment dressed by the cow with the crumpled horn in the house that Jack built. Unseen by the spy, Mr. Cruncher stood at his side and touched him on the shoulder like a ghostly bailiff.
"There, Roger Cly, master," said Mr. Cruncher, with a taciturn and iron-bound visage. "So you put him in his coffin?"
"I did."
"Who took him out of it?"
Barsad leaned back in his chair and stammered. What do you mean?"
"I mean," said Mr. Cruncher, "that he warn't never in it. Nah, not he. I'll have my head took off if he was ever in it."
The spy looked round at the two gentlemen. They both looked in unspeakable astonishment at Jerry.
"I'll tell you," said Jerry, "that you buried paving stones and earth in that there coffin. Don't go and tell me that you buried Cly. It was a taking. Me and two more knows it."
"How do you know it?"
"What's that to you?" "Here, cud," growled Mr. Cruncher. "It's you I've got a old grudge agin, is it? With your shameful impositions upon tradesmen. I'd catch hold of your throat and choke you for half a guinea."
Sidney Carton, who, with Mr. Lorry, had been lost in amazement at this turn of the business, here requested Mr. Cruncher to moderate and explain himself.
"Another time, sir," he returned evasively. "The present time is ill-convenient for explaining. What I stand to is that he knows well what that there Cly was never in that there coffin. Let him say he was in so much as a word of one syllable, and I'll either catch hold of his throat and choke him for half a guinea."
Mr. Cruncher dwelt upon this as quite a liberal offer.
"Or I'll out and announce him."
"I see one thing," said Cotton. "I hold another card, Mr. Barsad. Impossible here in raging Paris, with suspicion filling the air, for you to outlive denunciation, when you are in communication with another aristocratic spy of the same antecedents as yourself, who, moreover, has the mystery about him of having feigned death and come to life again. A plot in the prisons of the foreigner against the Republic. A strong card. A certain guillotine card. Do you play?"
"No," returned the spy. "I throw up. I confess that we were so unpopular with the outrageous mob that I only got away from England at the risk of being ducked to death, and that Cly was so ferreted up and down that he never would have got away at all but for that sham. Though how this man knows it was a sham is a wonder of wonders to me."
"Never you trouble your head about this man," retorted the contentious Mr. Cruncher. "You'll have trouble enough with giving your attention to that gentleman. And look here, once more."
Mr. Cruncher could not be restrained from making rather an ostentatious parade of his liberality.
"I'd catch hold of your throat and choke you for half a guinea."
The sheep of the prisons turned from him to Sidney Carton, and said with more decision, "It has come to a point. I go on duty soon and can't overstay my time. You told me you had a proposal. What is it? Now, it is of no use asking too much of me. Ask me to do anything in my office, putting my head in great extra danger, and I'd better trust my life to the chances of a refusal than the chances of consent. In short, I should make that choice. You talk of desperation. We're all desperate here. Remember? I may denounce you if I think proper, and I can swear my way through stone walls, and so can others. Now, what do you want with me?"
"Not very much."
"You're a turnkey at the conciergerie. I tell you, once for all, there is no such thing as an escape possible," said the spy firmly.
"Why need you tell me what I have not asked? You are a turnkey at the conciergerie."
"I am, sometimes."
"You can be, when you choose."
"I can pass in and out, when I choose." Sidney Carton filled another glass with brandy, poured it slowly out upon the hearth, and watched it as it dropped. "It being all spent," he said, rising, "so far we've spoken before these two, because it was as well that the merits of the cards should not rest solely between you and me. Come into the dark room here, and let us have one final word alone." Chapter 9. The Game Made. While Sidney Carton and the sheep of the prisons were in the adjoining dark room, speaking so low that not a sound was heard, Mr. Lorry looked at Jerry in considerable doubt and mistrust. That honest tradesman's manner of receiving the look did not inspire confidence. He changed the leg on which he rested as often as if he had 50 of those limbs and were trying them all. He examined his fingernails with a very questionable closeness of attention. And whenever Mr. Lorry's eye caught his, he was taken with that peculiar kind of short cough requiring the hollow of a hand before it, which is seldom, if ever, known to be an infirmity attendant on perfect openness of character.
"Jerry," said Mr. Lorry, "come here."
Mr. Cruncher came forward sideways, with one of his shoulders in advance of him.
"What have you been, besides a messenger?"
After some cogitation, accompanied with an intent look at his patron, Mr. Cruncher conceived the luminous idea of replying,
"Agricultural character."
"My mind misgives me much," said Mr. Lorry,
angrily shaking a forefinger at him, "that you have used the respectable and great house of Tellson's as a blind, and that you have had an unlawful occupation of an infamous description.
If you have, don't expect me to befriend you when you get back to England. If you have, don't expect me to keep your secret. Tellson's shall not be imposed upon."
"I hope, sir," pleaded the abashed Mr. Cruncher, "that a gentleman like yourself, what I've had the honour of odd-jobbing till I'm grey at it, would think twice about arming of me, even if it was so. I don't say it is, but even if it was. Now, which it is to be took into account that if it was, it wouldn't, even then, be all a one side. There'd be two sides to it. There might be medical doctors at the present hour a-picking up their guineas where a honest tradesman don't pick up his fardens. Fardens? No, not yet his half-fardens. Half-fardens? No, nor yet his quarter. A-banking away like smoke at Tilson's, and a-cocking their medical eyes at that tradesman on the sly, a-going in and going out to their own carriages. Ah, equally like smoke, if not more so. Well, that'd be imposing, too, on Tilson's. For you cannot sarse the goose and not the gander. And here's Mrs. Cruncher, or leastways was in the old England times, and would be tomorrow, if cause given, a flopping again the business to that degree as is ruinating. Stark ruinating. Whereas them medical doctors' wives don't flop. Catch them at it. Or if they flop, their toppings goes in favour of more patients. And how can you rightly have one without t'other? Then what with undertakers, and what with parish clerks, and what with sextons, and what with private watchmen, all avaricious,
and all in it, the man wouldn't get much by it even if it was so. And what little a man did get would never prosper with him, Mr. Lorry. He'd never have no good of it. He'd want all along to be out of the line, if he could see his way out, being once in, even if it was so.
Oh, cried Mr. Lorry, rather relenting nonetheless, I'm shocked at the sight of you.
Now, what I would humbly offer to you, sir, pursued Mr. Cruncher, even if it was so, which I don't say it is,
don't prevaricate, said Mr. Lorry.
No, I will not, sir,
returned Mr. Cruncher, as if nothing were further from his thoughts or practice,
which I don't say it is. What I would humbly offer to you, sir, would be this. Upon that there stool at that there bar, sets that there boy of mine, brought up and growed up to be a man, what will errand you, messenger, general light job you till your heels is where your head is, if such should be your wishes. If it was so, which I still don't say it is, for I will not prevaricate to you, sir, let that there boy keep his father's place and take care of his mother. Don't blow upon that boy's father. Do not do it, sir, and let that father go into the line of the regular digging and make amends for what he would have undug, if it was so, by digging of 'em in with a will and with convictions, respecting the future keeping of 'em safe. That, Mr. Lorry, said Mr. Cruncher, wiping his forehead with his arm as an announcement that he had arrived at the peroration of his discourse, is what I would respectfully offer to you, sir. A man don't see all this here a-going on dreadful round him in the way of subjects without heads, dear me, plentiful enough for to bring the price down to porterage, and hardly that without having his serious thoughts of things. And these here would be mine, if it was so, in treating of you for to bear in mind that what I said just now, I up and said in a good cause, when I might have kept it back.
That at least is true, said Mr. Lorry. Say no more now. It may be that I shall yet stand your friend, if you deserve it, and repent in action, not in words. I want no more words. Mr. Cruncher knuckled his forehead as Sidney Carton and the spy returned from the dark room.
Adieu, Mr. Barsad, said the former. Our arrangements thus made, you have nothing to fear from me.
He sat down in a chair on the hearth, over against Mr. Lorry. When they were alone, Mr. Lorry asked him what he had done. Not much. If it should go ill with the prisoner, I have ensured access to him once.
Mr. Lorry's countenance fell. It's all I could do, said Carton. To propose too much would be to put this man's head under the axe. And as he himself said, nothing worse could happen to him if he were denounced. It was obviously the weakness of the position. There is no help for it.
But access to him, said Mr. Lorry, if it should go ill before the tribunal, will not save him.
I never said it would.
Mr. Lorry's eyes gradually sought the fire. His sympathy with his darling and the heavy disappointment of his second arrest gradually weakened them. He was an old man now, overborne with anxiety of late, and his tears fell.
"You're a good man and a true friend," said Carton in an altered voice. "Forgive me if I notice that you are affected. I could not see my father weep and sit by, careless. And I could not respect your sorrow more if you were my father.
You are free from that misfortune, however."
Though he said the last words with a slip into his usual manner, there was a true feeling and respect both in his tone and in his touch that Mr. Lorry, who had never seen the better side of him, was wholly unprepared for. He gave him his hand, and Carton gently pressed it. "To return to poor Darnay," said Carton. "Don't tell her of this interview or this arrangement. It would not enable her to go to see him. She might think it was contrived, in case of the worst, to convey him to the means of anticipating the sentence."
Mr. Lorry had not thought of that, and he looked quickly at Carton to see if it were in his mind. It seemed to be. He returned the look, and evidently understood it. "She might think a thousand things," Carton said, "and any of them would only add to her trouble. Don't speak of me to her. As I said to you when I first came, I had better not see her. I can put my hand out to do any little helpful work for her that my hand can find to do without that. You're going to her, I hope. She must be very desolate tonight." "I am now going, directly. I'm glad of that. She has such a strong attachment to you and reliance on you. How does she look?"
"Anxious and unhappy, but very beautiful."
It was a long, grieving sound, like a sigh, almost like a sob. It attracted Mr. Lorry's eyes to Carton's face, which was turned to the fire. A light, or a shade, the old gentleman could not have said which, passed from it as swiftly as a change will sweep over a hillside on a wild, bright day, and he lifted his foot to put back one of the little flaming logs which was tumbling forward. He wore the white riding coat and top boots then in vogue, and the light of the fire, touching their light surfaces, made him look very pale, with his long brown hair, all untrimmed, hanging loose about him. His indifference to fire was sufficiently remarkable to elicit a word of remonstrance from Mr. Lorry. His boot was still upon the hot embers of the flaming log, when it had broken under the weight of his foot.
"I forgot it," he said.
Mr. Lorry's eyes were again attracted to his face. Taking note of the wasted air which clouded the naturally handsome features, and having the expression of prisoners' faces fresh in his mind, he was strongly reminded of that expression.
"And your duties here have drawn to an end, sir?"
said Carton, turning to him.
"Yes. As I was telling you last night when Lucy came in so unexpectedly, I have at length done all that I can do here. I hope to have left them in perfect safety and then to have quitted Paris. I have my leave to pass. I was ready to go."
They were both silent.
"Yours is a long life to look back upon, sir," said Carton, wistfully. "I'm in my 78th year.
You've been useful all your life, steadily and constantly occupied, trusted, respected, and looked up to. I've been a man of business ever since I've been a man. Indeed, I may say that I was a man of business when a boy. See what a place you fill at 78. How many people will miss you when you leave it empty?"
"A solitary old bachelor,"
answered Mr. Lorry, shaking his head.
"There's nobody to weep for me."
"How can you say that? Wouldn't she weep for you?
Wouldn't her child?"
"Yes, yes, thank God. I didn't quite mean what I said. It is a thing to thank God for, is it not?"
"Surely, surely. If you could say with truth to your own solitary heart tonight, I have secured to myself the love and attachment, the gratitude or respect, of no human creature. I have won myself a tender place in no regard. I have done nothing good or serviceable to be remembered by. Your 78 years would be 78 heavy curses, would they not?"
"You say truly, Mr. Carton.
I think they would."
Sidney turned his eyes again upon the fire, and after a silence of a few moments said,
"I should like to ask you, does your childhood seem far off? Do the days when you sat at your mother's knee seem days of very long ago?"
Responding to his softened manner, Mr. Lorry answered,
20 years back, yes. At this time of my life, no. For as I draw closer and closer to the end, I travel in the circle,
nearer and nearer to the beginning. Seems to be one of the kind smoothings and preparings of the way. My heart is touched now by many remembrances that had long fallen asleep, my pretty young mother, and I so old, and by many associations of the days when what we called the world was not so real with me, and my faults were not confirmed in me. "I understand the feeling," exclaimed Carton with a bright flush. "And you are the better for it?" "I hope so." Carton terminated the conversation here by rising to help him on with his outer coat. "But you," said Mr. Lorry, reverting to the theme, "you are young." "Yes," said Carton. "I am not old, but my young way was never the way to age." "Enough of me." "And of me, I am sure," said Mr. Lorry. "You going out?" "I'll walk with you to her gate. You know my vagabond and restless habits. If I should prowl about the streets a long time, don't be uneasy. I shall reappear in the morning. You go to the court tomorrow?" "Yes, unhappily." "I shall be there, but only as one of the crowd. My spy will find a place for me. Take my arm, sir." Mr. Lorry did so, and they went downstairs and out in the streets. A few minutes brought them to Mr. Lorry's destination. Carton left him there, but lingered at a little distance, and turned back to the gate again when it was shut, and touched it. He had heard of her going to the prison every day. "She came out here," he said, looking about him. "Turned this way. Must have trod on these stones often. Let me follow in her steps." It was 10 o'clock at night when he stood before the prison of La Force, where she had stood hundreds of times. A little wood sawyer, having closed his shop, was smoking his pipe at the shop door. "Good night, citizen," said Sidney Carton, pausing and going by. But the man eyed him inquisitively. "Good night, citizen. How goes the Republic?"
"You mean the guillotine? Not ill. 63 today. We shall mount to 100 soon. Samson and his men complain sometimes of being exhausted. He is so droll, that Samson. Such a barber."
"Do you often go to see him
shave?" "Always. Every day. What a barber. You've seen him at work?"
"Never."
"Go and see him when he has a good batch. Figure this to yourself, citizen. He shaved the 63 today in less than 2 pipes. Less than 2 pipes. Word of honour."
As the grinning little man held out the pipe he was smoking to explain how he timed the executioner, Carton was so sensible of a rising desire to strike the life out of him that he turned away.
"But you are not English," said the wood sawyer, "though you wear English dress."
"Yes," said Carton, pausing again and answering over his shoulder.
"You speak like a Frenchman."
"I'm an old student here."
"Ah, a perfect Frenchman. Good night, Englishman."
"Good night, citizen."
"But go and see that droll dog," the little man persisted, calling after him. "Take a pipe with you."
Sidney had not gone far out of sight when he stopped in the middle of the street under a glimmering lamp and wrote with his pencil on a scrap of paper. Then, traversing with the decided step of one who remembered the way well, several dark and dirty streets, much dirtier than usual, for the best public thoroughfares remained uncleansed in those times of terror, he stopped at a chemist's shop, which the owner was closing with his own hands. A small, dim, crooked shop, kept in a tortuous, uphill thoroughfare, by a small, dim, crooked man. Giving this citizen, too, good night, as he confronted him at his counter, he laid the scrap of paper before him. "Phew!" The chemist whistled softly as he read it. Sidney Carton took no heed, and the chemist said, "For you,
citizen?
For me.
You will be careful to keep them separate, citizen. You know the consequences of mixing them.
Perfectly. Certain small packets were made and given to him. He put them one by one in the breast of his inner coat, counted out the money for them, and deliberately left the shop.
There is nothing more to do,
said he, glancing upward at the moon. Until tomorrow.
I can't sleep.
It was not a reckless manner, the manner in which he said these words aloud under the fast-sailing clouds, nor was it more expressive of negligence than defiance. It was the settled manner of a tired man who had wandered and struggled and got lost, but who at length struck into his road and saw its end. Long ago, when he had been famous among his earliest competitors as a youth of great promise, he had followed his father to the grave. His mother had died years before. These solemn words which had been read at his father's grave arose in his mind as he went down the dark streets, among the heavy shadows, with the moon and the clouds sailing on high above him. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. In a city dominated by the axe, alone at night, with natural sorrow rising in him for the 63 who had been that day put to death, and for tomorrow's victims, then awaiting their doom in the prisons, and still of tomorrow's and tomorrow's, the chain of association that brought the words home, like a rusty old ship's anchor from the deep, might have been easily found. He did not seek it, but repeated them, and went on. With a solemn interest in the lighted windows where the people were going to rest, forgetful through a few calm hours of the horrors surrounding them, in the towers of the churches, where no prayers were said, for the popular revulsion had even travelled that length of self-destruction, from years of priestly impostors, plunderers and profligates. In the distant burial places, reserved, as they wrote upon the gates, for eternal sleep. In the abounding jails, and in the streets along which the 60s rolled to a death which had become so common and material, that no sorrowful story of a haunting spirit ever arose among the people out of all the working of the guillotine. With a solemn interest in the whole life and death of the city, settling down to its short nightly pause in fury, Sidney Carton crossed the Seine again for the lighter streets. Few coaches were abroad, for riders in coaches were liable to be suspected, and gentility hid its head in red nightcaps and put on heavy shoes and trudged. But the theatres were all well filled, the people poured cheerfully out as he passed, and went chatting home. At one of the theatre doors there was a little girl with a mother looking for a way across the street through the mud. He carried the child over, and before the timid arm was loosed from his neck, asked her for a kiss. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live, and whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Now that the streets were quiet and the night wore on, the words were in the echoes of his feet and were in the air. Perfectly calm and steady, he sometimes repeated them to himself as he walked, but he heard them always. The night wore out. And as he stood upon the bridge, listening to the water as it splashed the river walls of the island of Paris, where the picturesque confusion of houses and cathedrals shone, bright in the light of the moon, the day came coldly, looking like a dead face out of the sky. Then the night, with the moon and the stars, turned pale and died. And for a little while it seemed as if creation were delivered over to death's dominion. But the glorious sun, rising, seemed to strike those words, that burden of the night, straight and warm to his heart in its long, bright rays. And looking along them with reverently shaded eyes, a bridge of light appeared to span the air between him and the sun, while the river sparkled under it. The strong tide, so swift, so deep and certain, was like a congenial friend in the morning stillness. He walked by the stream, far from the houses, and in the light and warmth of the sun, fell asleep on the bank. When he awoke and was afoot again, he lingered there yet a little longer, watching an eddy that turned and turned, purposeless, until the stream absorbed it and carried it on to the sea. Like me. A trading boat with the sail of the softened colour of dead leaf then glided into his view, floated by him, and died away. As its silent track in the water disappeared, the prayer that had broken up out of his heart for a merciful consideration of all his poor blindnesses and errors ended in the words, "I am the resurrection and the life." Mr. Lorry was already out when he got back, and it was easy to surmise where the good old man was gone. Sidney Carton drank nothing but a little coffee, ate some bread, and having washed and changed to refresh himself, went out to the place of trial. The court was all astir and abuzz, when the black sheep, who many fell away from in dread, pressed him into an obscure corner among the crowd. Mr. Lorry was there, and Dr. Manette was there. She was there, sitting beside her father. When her husband was brought in, she turned a look upon him so sustaining, so encouraging, so full of admiring love and pitying tenderness, yet so courageous for his sake, that it called the healthy blood into his face, brightened his glance, and animated his heart. If there had been any eyes to notice the influence of her look on Sidney Carton, it would have been seen to be the same influence, exactly. Before that unjust tribunal, there was little or no order of procedure ensuring to any accused person any reasonable hearing. There could have been no such revolution if all laws, forms, and ceremonies had not first been so monstrously abused that the suicidal vengeance of the revolution was to scatter them all to the winds. Every eye was turned to the jury. The same determined patriots and good republicans as yesterday and the day before and tomorrow and the day after. Eager and prominent among them, one man with a craving face and his fingers perpetually hovering about his lips, whose appearance gave great satisfaction to the spectators. A life-thirsting, cannibal-looking, bloody-minded juryman. The Jacques III of Saint-Antoine. The whole jury as a jury of dogs, impanelled to try the deer. Every eye then turned to the five judges and the public prosecutor. No favourable leaning in that quarter today. A fell, uncompromising, murderous business meaning there. Every eye then sought some other eye in the crowd, and gleamed at it approvingly, and heads nodded at one another, before bending forward with a strained attention. Charles Evrémonde, called Darnay. Released yesterday, reaccused and retaken yesterday. Indictment delivered to him last night. Suspected and denounced enemy of the Republic, aristocrat, one of a family of tyrants, one of a race proscribed for that they had used their abolished privileges to the infamous oppression of the people. Charles Evrémonde, called Darnay, in right of such proscription, absolutely dead in law. To this effect, in as few or fewer words, the public prosecutor. The president asked, was the accused openly denounced or secretly? Openly, president. By whom? Three voices. Ernest Defarge, wine vendor of Saint-Antoine. Good. Thérèse Defarge, his wife. Good. Alexandre Manette, physician. A great uproar took place in the court, and in the midst of it, Dr. Manette was seen pale and trembling, standing where he had been seated. President, I indignantly protest to you that this is a forgery and a fraud. You know the accused to be the husband of my daughter. My daughter, and those dear to her, are far dearer to me than my life. Who and where is the false conspirator who says that I denounce the husband of my child? Citizen Manette, be tranquil.
To fail in submission to the authority of the tribunal would be to put yourself out of law. As to what is dearer to you than life, nothing can be so dear to a good citizen as the Republic."
Loud acclamations hailed this rebuke. The President rang his bell and with warmth resumed,
"If the Republic should demand of you the sacrifice of your child herself, you would have no duty but to sacrifice her. Listen to what is to follow. In the meanwhile, be silent."
Frantic acclamations were again raised. Dr. Manette sat down with his eyes looking around and his lips trembling. His daughter drew closer to him. The craving man on the jury rubbed his hands together and restored the usual hand to his mouth. Defarge was produced when the court was quiet enough to admit of his being heard, and rapidly expounded the story of the imprisonment, and of his having been a mere boy in the doctor's service, and of the release, and of the state of the prisoner when released and delivered to him. This short examination followed, for the court was quick with its work.
"You did good service at the taking of the Bastille, citizen?"
"I believe so."
Here an excited woman screeched from the crowd,
"You are one of the best patriots there! Why not say so? You were a cannoneer that day there, and you were among the first to enter the accursed fortress when it fell. Patriots, I speak the truth."
It was the Vengeance, who, amidst the warm commendations of the audience, thus assisted the proceedings. The President rang his bell, but the Vengeance, warming with encouragement, shrieked,
"I defy that bell!"
Wherein she was likewise much commended.
"Inform the tribunal of what you did that day within the Bastille, citizen."
"I knew," said Defarge, looking down at his wife, who stood at the bottom of the steps on which he was raised, looking steadily up at him.
"I knew that this prisoner of whom I speak had been confined in a cell known as 105 North Tower.
I knew it from himself. He knew himself by no other name than 105 North Tower when he made shoes under my care. As I served my gun that day, I resolve, when the place shall fall, to examine that cell. It falls. I mount to the cell, with a fellow citizen, who is one of the jury, directed by a jailer. I examine it very closely. In a hole in the chimney, where a stone has been worked out and replaced, I find a written paper. This is that written paper. I have made it my business to examine some specimens of the writing of Dr. Manette. This is the writing of Dr. Manette. I confide this paper in the writing of Dr. Manette to the hands of the President. Let it be read."
In a dead silence and stillness, the prisoner under trial looking lovingly at his wife only looking from him to look with solicitude at her father, Dr. Manette keeping his eyes fixed on the reader, Madame Defarge never taking hers from the prisoner, Defarge never taking his from his feasting wife, and all the other eyes there, intent upon the doctor, who saw none of them, the paper was read as follows. Chapter 10. The Substance of the Shadow. I, Alexandre Manette, unfortunate physician, native of Beauvais, and afterwards resident in Paris, write this melancholy paper in my doleful cell in the Bastille during the last months of the year 1767. I write it at stolen intervals under every difficulty. I design to secrete it in the wall of the chimney, where I have slowly and laboriously made a place of concealment for it. Some pitying hand may find it there when I and my sorrows are dust. These words are formed by the rusty iron point with which I write with difficulty, in scrapings of soot and charcoal from the chimney mixed with blood, in the last month of the 10th year of my captivity. Hope has quite departed from my breast. I know from terrible warnings I have noted in myself that my reason will not long remain unimpaired. But I solemnly declare that I am at this time in the possession of my right mind, that my memory is exact and circumstantial, and that I write the truth as I shall answer for these my last recorded words, whether they ever be read by men or not, at the eternal judgment seat. One cloudy moonlight night in the third week of December, I think the 22nd of the month, in the year 1757, I was walking on a retired part of the quay by the Seine for the refreshment of the frosty air at an hour's distance from my place of residence in the street of the School of Medicine, when a carriage came along behind me, driven very fast. As I stood aside to let that carriage pass, apprehensive that it might otherwise run me down, a head was put out at the window, and a voice called to the driver to stop. The carriage stopped as soon as the driver could rein in his horses, and the same voice called to me by my name. I answered. The carriage was then so far in advance of me that two gentlemen had time to open the door and alight before I came up with it. I observed that they were both wrapped in cloaks, and appeared to conceal themselves. As they stood side by side near the carriage door, I also observed that they both looked of about my own age, or rather younger, and that they were greatly alike in stature, manner, voice, and as far as I could see, face, too. "You are Dr. Manette," said one. "I am." "Dr. Manette, formerly of Beauvais," said the other, "the young physician, originally an expert surgeon, who within the last year or two has made a rising reputation in Paris." "Gentlemen," I returned, "I am that Dr. Manette of whom you speak so graciously." "We have been to your residence," said the first, "and not being so fortunate as to find you there, and being informed that you were probably walking in this direction, we followed in the hope of overtaking you. Will you please to enter the carriage?" The manner of both was imperious, and they both moved as these words were spoken, so as to place me between themselves and the carriage door. They were armed. I was not. "Gentlemen," said I, "pardon me, but I usually inquire who does me the honour to seek my assistance, and what is the nature of the case to which I am summoned?" The reply to this was made by him who had spoken second. "Doctor, your clients are people of condition. As to the nature of the case, our confidence in your skill assures us that you will ascertain it for yourself better than we can describe it. Enough. Will you please to enter the carriage?" I could do nothing but comply, and I entered it in silence. They both entered after me, the last springing in after putting up the steps. The carriage turned about and drove on at its former speed. I repeat this conversation exactly as it occurred. I have no doubt that it is word for word the same. I describe everything exactly as it took place, constraining my mind not to wander from the task. Where I make the broken marks that follow here, I leave off for the time and put my paper in its hiding place. The carriage left the streets behind, passed the north barrier, and emerged upon the country road. At two-thirds of a league from the barrier, I did not estimate the distance at that time, but afterwards, when I traversed it, it struck out of the main avenue and presently stopped at a solitary house. We all three alighted and walked by a damp, soft footpath in a garden where a neglected fountain had overflowed to the door of the house. It was not opened immediately in answer to the ringing of the bell, and one of my two conductors struck the man who opened it with his heavy riding glove across the face. There was nothing in this action to attract my particular attention, for I had seen common people struck more commonly than dogs. But the other of the two, being angry likewise, struck the man in like manner with his arm. The look and bearing of the brothers were then so exactly alike that I then first perceived them to be twin brothers. From the time of our alighting at the outer gate, which we found locked, and which one of the brothers had opened to admit us and had relocked, I had heard cries proceeding from an upper chamber. I was conducted to this chamber straight, the cries growing louder as we ascended the stairs, and I found a patient in a high fever of the brain, lying on a bed. The patient was a woman of great beauty and young, assuredly not much past 20. Her hair was torn and ragged, and her arms were bound to her sides with sashes and handkerchiefs. I noticed that these bonds were all portions of a gentleman's dress. On one of them, which was a fringed scarf for a dress of ceremony, I saw the armorial bearings of a noble and the letter E. I saw this within the first minutes of my contemplation of the patient. for in her restless strivings she had turned over on her face on the edge of the bed, had drawn the end of the scarf into her mouth, and was in danger of suffocation. My first act was to put out my hand to relieve her breathing, and in moving the scarf aside, the embroidery in the corner caught my sight. I turned her gently over, placed my hands upon her breast to calm her and keep her down, and looked into her face. Her eyes were dilated and wild, and she constantly uttered piercing shrieks and repeated the words, "My husband, my father, and my brother," and then counted up to 12 and said, "Hush!" For an instant, and no more, she would pause to listen, and then the piercing shrieks would begin again, and she would repeat the cry, "My husband, my father, and my brother," and would count up to 12 and say, "Hush!" There was no variation in the order or the manner. There was no cessation, but the regular moment's pause in the utterance of these sounds. "How long," I asked, "has this lasted?" To distinguish the brothers, I will call them the elder and the younger. By the elder, I mean him who exercised the most authority. It was the elder who replied, "Since about this hour last night." "She has a husband, a father, and a brother?" "A brother." "I do not address her brother?" He answered with great contempt, "No." "She has some recent association with the number 12? The younger brother impatiently rejoined, "With 12 o'clock? "See, gentlemen," said I, still keeping my hands upon her breast, "how useless I am, as you have brought me. If I had known what I was coming to see, I could have come provided. As it is, time must be lost. There are no medicines to be obtained in this lonely place." The elder brother looked to the younger, who said haughtily, "There's a case of medicines here," and brought it from a closet and put it on the table. I opened some of the bottles, smelt them, and put the stoppers to my lips. If I had wanted to use anything save narcotic medicines that were poisons in themselves, I would not have administered any of those. "Do you doubt them?" said the younger brother. "You see, monsieur, I am going to use them," I replied, and said no more. I made the patient swallow with great difficulty, and after many efforts the dose that I desired to give. As I intended to repeat it after a while, and as it was necessary to watch its influence, I then sat down by the side of the bed. There was a timid and suppressed woman in attendance, wife of the man downstairs, who had retreated into a corner. The house was damp and decayed, indifferently furnished, evidently recently occupied and temporarily used. Some thick old hangings had been nailed up before the windows to deaden the sound of the shrieks. They continued to be uttered in their regular succession, with the cry, "My husband, my father, and my brother," the counting up to 12, and "Hush!" The frenzy was so violent that I had not unfastened the bandages restraining the arms, but I had looked to them to see that they were not painful. The only spark of encouragement in the case was that my hand upon the sufferer's breast had this much soothing influence that for minutes at a time it tranquillized the figure. It had no effect upon the cries. No pendulum could be more regular. For the reason that my hand had this effect, I assume, I had sat by the side of the bed for half an hour, with the two brothers looking on, before the elder said, "There's another patient." I was startled and asked, "Is it a pressing case?" "You'd better see," he carelessly answered, and took up a light. The other patient lay in a back room across a second staircase, which was a species of loft over a stable. There was a low plastered ceiling to a part of it. The rest was open to the ridge of the tiled roof, and there were beams across. Hay and straw were stored in that portion of the place, faggots for firing, and a heap of apples in sand. I had to pass through that part to get at the other. My memory is circumstantial and unshaken. I try it with these details, and I see them all, in this my cell in the Bastille, near the close of the 10th year of my captivity, as I saw them all that night. On some hay on the ground with a cushion thrown under his head lay a handsome peasant boy, a boy of not more than 17 at the most. He lay on his back with his teeth set, his right hand clenched on his breast, and his glaring eyes looking straight upward. I could not see where his wound was as I kneeled on one knee over him, but I could see that he was dying of a wound from a sharp point. "I am a doctor, my poor fellow," said I. "Let me examine it."
"I do not want it examined," he answered. "Let it be."
It was under his hand, and I soothed him to let him move his hand away. The wound was a sword thrust, received from 20 to 24 hours before, but no skill could have saved him if it had been looked to without delay. He was then dying fast. As I turned my eyes to the elder brother, I saw him looking down at this handsome boy whose life was ebbing out as if he were a wounded bird or hare or rabbit, not at all as if he were a fellow creature. "How has this been done, monsieur?" said I.
"The crazed young common dog, a serf, forced my brother to draw upon him, and has fallen by my brother's sword, like a gentleman."
There was no touch of pity, sorrow, or kindred humanity in this answer. The speaker seemed to acknowledge that it was inconvenient to have that different order of creature dying there, and that it would have been better if he had died in the usual obscure routine of his vermin kind. He was quite incapable of any compassionate feeling about the boy or about his fate. The boy's eyes had slowly moved to him as he had spoken, and they now slowly moved to me.
"Doctor, they are very proud, these nobles. But we common dogs are proud, too, sometimes. They plunder us, outrage us, beat us, kill us. But we have a little pride left, sometimes."
"Have you seen her, doctor?" The shrieks and the cries were audible there, though subdued by the distance. He referred to them as if she were lying in our presence. I said, "I have seen her. She is my sister, doctor. They have had their shameful rites, these nobles, in the modesty and virtue of our sisters many years. But we have had good girls among us. I know it, and have heard my father say so. She was a good girl. She was betrothed to a good young man, too, a tenant of his. We were all tenants of his. That man's who stands there. The other is his brother. The worst of a bad race." It was with the greatest difficulty that the boy gathered bodily force to speak, but his spirit spoke with a dreadful emphasis. "We were so robbed by that man who stands there, as all we common dogs are by those superior beings, taxed by him without mercy, obliged to work for him without pay, obliged to grind our corn at his mill, obliged to feed scores of his tame birds on our wretched crops, and forbidden for our lives to keep a single tame bird of our own, pillaged and plundered to that degree that when we chanced to have a bit of meat, we ate it in fear, that the door barred and the shutters closed, that his people should not see it and take it from us. I say we were so robbed and hunted, and were made so poor, that our father told us it was a dreadful thing to bring a child into the world, and that what we should most pray for was that our women might be barren, and our miserable race die out." I had never before seen the sense of being oppressed bursting forth like a fire. I had supposed that it must be latent in the people somewhere, but I had never seen it break out until I saw it in the dying boy. "Nevertheless, doctor, my sister married. He was ailing at that time, poor fellow, and she married her lover that she might tend and comfort him in our cottage, our dog hut, as that man would call it. She had not been married many weeks when that man's brother saw her and admired her and asked that man to lend her to him. For what are husbands among us? He was willing enough, but my sister was good and virtuous and hated his brother with a hatred as strong as mine. What did the two, then, to persuade her husband to use his influence with her, to make her willing?" The boy's eyes, which had been fixed on mine, slowly turned to the looker-on, and I saw in the two faces that all he said was true. The two opposing kinds of pride confronting one another, I can see, even in this Bastille. The gentlemen's, all negligent indifference, the peasants, all trodden down sentiment and passionate revenge. "You know, Doctor, that it is among the rights of these nobles to harness us common dogs to carts and drive us. They so harnessed him and drove him. You know that it is among their rights to keep us in their grounds all night, quieting the frogs in order that their nobles